Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that I have written. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the 5 books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. You will discover there some articles that I produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice after all. That has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We continue our exposition of Paul's first epistle to Timothy. We're almost into chapter 6, but we still have a couple of verses at the end of chapter 5 relating to the choice of elders. Having interjected in verse 23 an urgent personal footnote that came to Paul's mind when he was thinking about conscientious impartiality in the choice of elders, the apostle picks up the thread he dropped in verse 22 and comes back to explain another reason why haste in the appointment of church leaders is not good. We elaborated a great deal on that, and if you didn't hear that, you might go to our archives and listen at your own convenience. Speaking of the appointment of elders, Paul says to Timothy, his protege, who's functioning in the role of pastor, actually the first among equals, among the elders or pastors there in Ephesus, he tells Timothy a fact of life that he needs to be aware of in the choice of elders. The sins of some men are quite evident, going before them to judgment. For others, their sins follow after. Likewise also, the deeds that are not good are quite evident, and those which are otherwise cannot be concealed. When one begins to evaluate a man's fitness for the ministry, for the leadership of a church, the sins of some men, to use Paul's words here, are quite obvious. That is, they run before them like steeds pulling a carriage. They're apparent to everybody, but not in every case. We all know that some people put up a nice front. They're those folk who are really prepossessing. They look good on the surface, but they have a dark side, maybe even a horrible one, like the BTK serial killer who was the president of his Lutheran church in Wichita, Kansas. But that's a very, very extreme case. But Paul has in mind others also who are not at all hypocrites. The fact is, the virtues of some persons, we all know, we've seen it, they really stick out initially. They stick out to such an extent that they obscure the chinks in those folks' armor in a way that a woman's otherwise fine physical form may hide some serious problems that will later become all too evident. Given that reality, what Paul is saying to Timothy is, be careful. Picking church leaders takes time. It all goes back to what he said earlier. Do not lay hands upon people too hastily. So be careful to test people. Give the vetting process adequate time for the disqualifying aspects of one's life to appear. I've seen that so many times. I can remember one time a man who came to us from another venue. I'd known him in another context, not real well, but known him. And again, he was the prepossessing type, and he was also the possessing type. He had a good deal of money. I didn't know it at the time, but it became clear that he liked to use his wealth more or less to buy influence. He was a man who was used to kind of having his way and walking his way in through his wealth. If he had, as he desired when he was early on in his life in our church, been invited to be a part of an elder board, for hey, wherever he had been, he had always been a leader, it would have been a disaster. But as time went on, it became apparent that this individual, for all of the leadership roles that he had had in various churches, and for all of his business success, was really a very, very insecure personality. That was not obvious. The good things went before him. It's like with a lot of people. You could see the good things, and you think this person would be great, so we don't need more time. This person could be a player. But with more time, he got more frustrated because he wasn't a leader. But more time proved this is not a person that you want to be a leader. And eventually, his frustrations led him to cut and run and go somewhere else, which was all to the good. You see that kind of thing all the time. He wasn't a bad person. He didn't have a dark and an ugly side, didn't have a criminal side or anything of that nature. But he had some sides that were not mature, they were not godly, they would have created problems. So this process needs time. Look them over carefully, Paul says. In the same vein, in verse 25, the apostle notes, everybody can see and attest to a person's good deeds, but time will expose the dark underbelly. They cannot forever be concealed. The truth will come out. So Timothy, in choosing church leaders, don't rush to judgment and install people in ministry who don't belong there and prevent some from entering who were better men than first appeared. Time is your friend. Be patient. Do your due diligence. Check them out carefully. That is something that I, again, have seen in the course of my pastoral ministry. There are individuals who may have some edges. They may have certain vices. We all do. They are the type where they're obvious. They may, for example, have a little bit too short a fuse. Or it may not be too short a fuse. They may be a little gruff. They don't have the best bedside manner, things like that. But the more you're around them, the more you watch them over time, it's just the polar opposite of the other kind. Time is your friend. And these people who right up front in the grill, to use an auto metaphor, may not look so attractive over time, you begin to realize, you know, there's a wonderful solidity about that person. You know, for all these rough edges, they really are grounded. For those rough edges, they really have a good and godly heart. And then you can embrace them and bring them into leadership. So, Timothy, this is just a study in human nature. Be ready. This is just a little footnote in human nature, Timothy. Just to give you a heads up, this is reality. Work accordingly. I've learned all these things in the course of my ministry. I've seen it because I've been raised in the belly and the womb of the church and in my academic ministry. I've been down many roads and I've seen many situations. and I know how wise this advice is, and I paid the price for ignoring it. Now we come to the last chapter of 1 Timothy, 1 Timothy 6, where Paul gives instructions regarding the duties of slaves and masters to each other. I remind you again, as I've reminded you before in the course of this study, this is not a pastoral manual per se. It's a letter written to Paul's protege, but there's all kinds of pastoral instructional material in here. Paul explained his purpose in chapter 3, verse 15. I'm writing so that you may know how one ought to conduct oneself in the household of God. Serious business. The household of God is the church of the living God. This is a sacred thing. It's a pillar and support of the truth. Fragile. Sacred. Handle it with care. So that's why we have these instructions to Timothy. Greco-Roman society in the time of the New Testament church was largely a slave population. All the conquered peoples of the Romans, not that many were Roman citizens, but all the conquered peoples of the Romans were slaves. Some of them may have been well-educated. They may have been top dogs before their countries were conquered, but they were slaves. And some were the poorest of slaves. Some managed to get good positions with Roman citizens. But it was largely a slave population in a two-tier society. And the church, as I've explained from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, consisted largely of the lower class. There was no middle class, basically. It was lower class and upper class. And just like the Jewish-Gentile tensions, the slave-master tension, because there would be some like Philemon, there would be some who were wealthy, and they were slave owners in Greco-Roman society. And so you would have this mix, mostly slaves, but also some masters. So Paul addresses this as Christians. How do we deal with this in the church? Well, he tells them, let all who are under the yoke as slaves regard their own masters as worthy of all honor. For this reason, so that the name of God and our doctrine may not be spoken against. On the other hand, let those who have believers as their masters not be disrespectful to them, because they are brethren, but let them serve them all the more, because those who partake of the benefits are believers and beloved. And again he tells Timothy, teach and preach these principles. Do it regularly. Be constant about it. Now, as I indicated, slavery was an ingrained feature of ancient societies. The populace not killed in conflict were subjugated to the victors. Many would be carted off to other lands. They'd be sold on the open market as slaves, human trafficking. By no means were all these slaves an undereducated underclass of conquered peoples. In fact, many were better educated and they were more cultured than their masters. And many of them were assigned the task of educating the children of their masters. Nor must we assume that slaves were generally and regularly brutalized by their masters. That was not the case. Many undoubtedly were. We all know power, as Lord Acton so famously said, corrupts. And absolute power, no matter where it shows up, corrupts absolutely. That, at least, is the tendency. It is never right when human beings are reduced in the eyes of those in authority over them to mere chattel or property, rather than being seen as fellow human beings also created in the image and likeness of God and deserving of the same respect. Unfortunately, that's not the way it usually worked, but it was supposed to work that way in the church, and it worked pretty well. But I'm sure there were times when things got tense and Christian principles were not properly applied. In any event, as an institution, slavery was a cultural given as much as Roman imperialism was a given, as much as the Roman emperor was a given, and so forth. And Christianity was birthed in this context. Christianity did not create the institution of slavery, nor did it promote it, nor did it attempt, by the way, by political agitation to subvert it, any more than it sought by political means to subvert and overthrow the autocratic power of the Roman emperor. And from that we ought to take some lessons. Before we go on into the text, let's ask why not. Many have asked that, and they ask because they profoundly misunderstand two things. One, those who ask why Christianity didn't take on the institution of slavery have behind their question a very American assumption. And what is that? The assumption that personal and political freedom is the summum bonum, the ultimate good of life, the key to personal happiness. It is, to use the Latin phrase, the sine qua non of our existence, meaning without which nothing. Now, folks, as Christians, we enjoy, I enjoy, and I appreciate as much as anybody else, the benefit of political freedom. I'd rather have it than not have it. We all like the liberty to do within reasonable and legal limits pretty much as we please. That said, it is no tenet of Christianity that democracy is God's chosen form of government. Some American Christians seem to think so, but they're as wrong as they can be. And it is no tenet of biblical Christianity that part of the mission of the church should be to gain political freedom for all men on earth and to establish democracies everywhere. So when people ask the question why Christianity didn't take on the institution of slavery directly, their assumptions are false. That's not what Christianity is about. That's not what we're here to do. I say again, it's not our assumption that political freedom is the summum bonum of life, the ultimate good. And it is no tenet of Christianity that democracy is God's chosen form of government. I'm repeating myself deliberately. And it's no part of Christian theology that the mission of the church should be to gain, fight for political freedom for all men on earth and to establish democracies everywhere. To some people, what I'm saying is totally radical, maybe even scary. But I'll speak dogmatically. I'm not wrong on that. That is not, and never has been, and never should be, a part of the mission of the Christian church. But some, with their ideas of liberation theology, have made it so. And that is a heresy. God has never revealed, nor has God ever taught us to proclaim to the world, that a democratic state is the best of all political states to live in. And God has never revealed, and God has never taught us, that political freedom is a better soil for spiritual nurture than the lack of the same. That is not what the gospel proclaims to oppressed men. What the gospel proclaims, whether to bond slaves or free men, is spiritual, not political freedom in Christ. What the gospel proclaims is elevation into the family and the fellowship of God. Political freedom, folks, like material abundance, well, hey, it may be icing on the earthly cake, but neither political freedom nor material abundance is a Christian pursuit per se, nor an arch value. But this perverse prosperity theology thinks that that should be a Christian pursuit, material abundance. So, that is one reason the Christian church historically has not been directly involved or entangled itself in politics in an attempt to displace authoritarian regimes. Rather, we are taught as Christians, and we teach believers everywhere, to honor and respect and to submit to whatever regime or political system they live under, up to the point where Caesar begins to demand of us what belongs of God, up to the point that Caesar demands of us what would put us in direct conflict with our duties to God himself. There we cannot go. So that's one reason. There is a second reason why Christians did not set out to overthrow the political status quo. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about 1 Timothy chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, where Paul is giving Timothy instructions about how to direct slaves to live with their masters. A second reason why Christians did not set out to overthrow the political status quo in Greco-Roman times and did not take on its established institutions, parenthetically I say, except where they directly conflicted with our duties to God, is this. The mission of the Christian church is not, as some seem to think, it's not to change or transform cultures. and political institutions per se. Rather, it is to transform individuals one by one through the proclamation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And if that transforms cultures and institutions, so be it. Praise God. But if it isn't, we'll be content to be salt in the earth and light in the world, to be a Christian presence under whatever conditions. Folks, we Christians are not about transforming cultures and political systems. Christianity is all about, I say again, transforming individuals by the power of God and setting them spiritually free to serve Him. When enough people are changed, they change their environment. And they do it not by boisterous revolution, but by quiet spiritual evolution. As they individually adopt different principles, they live by different precepts, they embrace different values. That difference eventually percolates to the top. Finally, as we have seen in the Western world, oppressive political structures and the unsavory institutions that reflected the old, they decayed, though unevenly. They were gradually modified and eventually maybe even eliminated by the leavening influence of a one-by-one conversion of individuals over time. The church, like its head, works from within, not without, to recreate persons who in turn gradually influence new directions and new values within a culture. So, the strategy of the apostles in the early church was not to make the world safe for democracy. Rather, the strategy of the apostles in the early church was to set people free from the spiritually enslaving influence of the world, the flesh, and the devil. They called upon those who were politically free to live as slaves of Christ, and it declared those who were slaves of men Christ's free men. Just because one is a slave in body does not mean that he has to be a slave in spirit. A believer, physical slave or not, is free from that worst and most notorious slave master of all, sin. If one remains enthralled to sin, one is a captive of the devil, and one is kept in tow by the world. And when that is the case, all the political freedom on earth is irrelevant. He's a slave in the worst and most deadly sense of the term. That's the reason so many people run around, they're oppressed, even though they're free in a democracy, but they're still oppressed. The problem is they're spiritually oppressed. They feel oppressed. They're slaves of sin. It's not the political system. So those are at least two reasons why in the writings of the apostles, you do not find them weighing in on the subject of slavery. Neither do you find Jesus doing it. You do not find Jesus and the apostles promoting street marches and encouraging seditious activities to overthrow the sometimes autocratic power of Rome. Political freedom or democracy is not our gospel, and the object of the gospel is spiritual freedom of individuals, not the transformation of cultures per se. Yet, with the understanding that you change the world by changing people, not the other way around. You don't change people by changing the world. So with those perspectives and that explanation of why the apostles in the early church did not overtly attack the institution of slavery, but chose to undermine it from the inside out on an individual basis and declaw it, we will now consider the exhortations of the apostle to the church through Timothy, his apostolic emissary there in Ephesus. God bless you and have a wonderful day. Join us again next time.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.